Welcome to Enabled, the weekly program about people just like you who are dealing with issues of vision loss. The program is designed to encourage you through news you can use, inspirational stories, and interviews. I'm Nancy Zimmer, your host for Enabled. Thank you for joining me. What is a bat mitzvah? When a Jewish girl turns 12, she assumes all the rights and obligations of a Jewish adult. From that date, she takes her place in the Jewish community. It's like a coming-of-age ceremony for Jewish girls. Prior to reaching bat mitzvah age, the girl's parents hold the responsibility for the girl's actions. After this age, the girls bear their own responsibility for Jewish ritual law, tradition, and ethics, and they are able to participate in all areas of Jewish community life. There are many traditions that define a bat mitzvah ceremony. This article explains how one determined young Jewish girl who is blind managed to become a bat mitzvah. The headline reads, the article comes from the Washington Post. A bat mitzvah girl debuts a new way for blind Jews to participate in an ancient tradition. Batya Sperling Milner, that's the girl's name, Batya Sperling Milner, who is blind, spent months preparing for her Orthodox Jewish bat mitzvah. She rehearsed her ceremony on January 9th thanks to new technology. And here is her story, written by Michelle Borstein. It was published on January 14th in 2019. When 12-year-old Batya Sperling Milner stood before her community at her bat mitzvah, a key coming-of-age ritual for Jews, she read from the Torah, just like any other Jewish kid. At the same time, the Saturday service at Ohev Shalom Synagogue on a snowy D.C. Sabbath morning was absolutely unique to the little girl with the brown bob and the elaborate henna on her left hand. The third of four children in a devout modern Orthodox family, the daughter of a mother who was a Jewish educator and a father who was a lay cantor, Sperling Milner never considered she would not have a bat mitzvah, the ceremony marking the time when a Jew becomes responsible for keeping Jewish law. For kids in her crew, it's also a key party when you literally get showered with candy and gifts and receive a turn at the pulpit. For Sperling Milner, who is blind, and her family, it was just a question of how it would all happen. It turned out that reading the Torah in a service and reading from the holy book for your community is a central ritual of a bat mitzvah. This presents challenges for a blind person. This Northwest Washington family thought innovations might be needed, so they went on a journey to find them. By the end, Sperling Milner's mother, Eliza Sperling, wound up writing a 40-page paper that made the case for blind Torah readers and lectured from it in synagogue, launching a new conversation in the D.C. area's modern Orthodox community. And a software engineer created encoding and a computer program that may wind up transforming the Torah reading experience for visually impaired people. It all began last year when Sperling Milner, who was then age 11, began to study the prayers and the Torah section connected with the date of her bat mitzvah. She is already accustomed to often needing to get special school materials created on topics all the way from Judaics to math because they aren't always available for people who are visually impaired. And to learn the nearly 1 hour of services that she would be leading in Hebrew, an organization called the Jewish Braille Institute, I'll tell you more about that later. The organization Jewish Braille Institute was creating for her big, fat, wide books of Braille Hebrew scripture. But her family hadn't known that there was no Braille system for what's called a TROP, T-R-O-P. There was no Braille system for the TROP. These are symbols that are above and below the Hebrew letters of the text that instruct the reader to sing the specific ritual chants or sounds to make at each word. There are about 20 TROPs, and each has several notes or sounds, like a short tune. Once Sperling Milner started to practice last spring, she and her family realized that they had the problem. Here's a quote. "How far did we get, Batya?" Joshua Milner, age 45, who was a National Institutes of Health researcher of pediatric allergies and immunology, asked earlier this month of his second daughter during a practice session at Ohev Shalom. "Not very far," she said, memorizing nearly an hour of the TROPS without being able to read them in practice, that is, read them in Braille, while learning the long Torah section seemed daunting to her. Forging ahead was the only option, they recalled. Here's a quote, she said, "I didn't think about it. I just knew I was going to do it." The number of people in this situation is tiny. According to the National Federation of the Blind, there are about 62,000 blind children in the United States, and Jews make up a little less than 2% of the U.S. population, according to Pew Research. But Sperling Milner comes from a segment of the Jewish population that is even smaller. This is a segment that works to live by very deliberately, the Jewish population segment that works to live very deliberately in decisions small and large by Jewish law. It's not that there aren't Jewish kids, sighted or blind, who never really learn the TROP markings. Some may listen to a cantor singing on a tape and try to memorize them. Sperling Milner happened to get assigned a day with a longer than usual segment of scripture called the Torah portion by Jews, and she wanted to read the full thing by herself, along with the additional prayers that less devout children sometimes don't even learn. That led a family friend in Israel, his name is Danny Sadanoff, who is a software engineer, to passionately take up the question of how to quickly create a system that she could use to study. Over time, Sadanoff created two things. He made a Braille character to stick in the middle of a Hebrew Braille word that signals a TROP is coming, and then new Braille characters for all the TROPs. Then he wrote a computer program that translates the TROP and combines it with existing Braille Bibles so that a reader can select any Bible verse and have the text with TROP. Then a printer can spit out the corresponding Braille on paper. The key challenge for the family is that they are modern Orthodox, a group within Orthodoxy wishing to live completely according to the rules of the Torah, while also living and adapting to the modern world. For such Jews, messing up a single letter of the Torah or a single note of the chants would render her service problematic. For liberal Jews, which is the vast majority of American Jews, meeting every detail of the law like that wouldn't matter as much. But there were bigger issues for the family that went well beyond Sperling Milner's access to materials and the difficulty of the task for her. The family also wanted the girl and her community to fully accept her reading. And in Orthodox Judaism, faith means religious practice, and there are rules and debates that go back millennia about who qualifies to carry out these practices. In preparing Sperling Milner for her bat mitzvah, the family confronted the reality that there has long been a rabbinical debate about whether blind people, along with illiterate people, under Jewish law, qualify to, quote-unquote, read the Torah before the community as public leaders. This debate began centuries ago, before publishing, when many, many were illiterate. The rabbis banned public readers who memorized rather than read the Torah. God's mandate was so important that nothing could be left to error. Here's a quote. "The rabbis felt there was deep importance in seeing and reading the scroll. After all, reading publicly is reenacting God giving Jews the Torah at Mount Sinai. Every time we read, we are liturgically reenacting Matan Torah." This is a quote from Lauren Tuckman, a blind conservative rabbi from D.C., and she was speaking of the Hebrew term for the biblical story of the Jews receiving the scripture. She finishes by saying, "We want to honor the Torah, giving honor as we read it." This issue set Sperling, the girl's mother, on a quest that resulted on January 1st in a 2.5-hour weekday lecture at the synagogue on this topic. She argued, the girl's mother, argued that blind Jews should be allowed to read from a Braille Torah. As a respected Jewish educator in the synagogue, Sperling's case convinced some in the congregation that a blind person can count as a reader. For others, it simply opened up a topic that they had never considered. Her paper argues that, in part, some of the older arguments against blind people reading have been rendered null by the creation of the Hebrew Braille in the 1940s. She also argues for the pain felt by Jews who were kept from full access to the Torah. Tushman, who is part of the more liberal conservative movement and works with young Jews, said she can relate. She says, when we say you can't because of who you are, we are sending a very alienated message. And there is no question people are told they are spiritual outsiders, she said. If we are going to be in the highest degree of spiritual leadership, we have to know every Jew is part of the Jewish community. Traditional Jews who care about following the law closely, she said, are balancing how to honor tradition along with being pragmatic. Sperling Miller, the young girl now, who grew up being read Torah stories at bedtime by her mom, said it was important to her to do what her friends could do, but also to do it by the book. Holding close the thick text of white Braille papers created just for her to practice, Sperling Milner said during one weekday rehearsal that, "When I stand up here, I think about people who read before me, and I want to do what they did," she said. "I want to do what you're supposed to do according to Jewish law. If this could become my Torah, it would mean a lot," referring to the Braille Torah that she had with her. On her special day, friends painted her left hand. She uses both hands to read Braille, but is a lefty. They painted her left hand with henna to look like a yad. It's a Y-A-D. The yad is a pointer device that sighted people use to read from an actual Torah without touching the sacred page. So her hand is painted like that. It is accompanied by a picture, and it's a beautiful picture showing a design on her, the upper part of her hand. A lot of the little lobes in the design have Braille characters, Braille figures on them. And then the henna extends down the pointer finger to create this yad effect with using her pointer finger on her left hand. Beautiful picture. And the article continues by saying she gave an analysis in English about her segment, which included God plunging the Egyptians into darkness as one of the plagues set upon them as the Jews fled. Of all the sections in the Torah on which her day could have been, Saturday was about darkness, she said, with a sense of humor in her voice. It must be a sign from God. Her reading impressed the congregation. A quote, "Every single person in the synagogue showed up to hear her read, and we all felt we were in the presence of greatness," said Rabbi Shmuel Hirschfeld, the rabbi at Ohev Shalom. That night at her party, Sperling Milner's parents played a special slideshow of photos from her life. It's a popular choice for such parties, and it's what the girl wanted, even if she couldn't see it herself. Even so, she wanted to show her community the different parts of her life, just like any other bat mitzvah girl would. And Saturday, she did. Now, I said I would continue by giving you information about the Jewish Braille Institute, and I have that now for you. JBI International is what the article is titled. This comes from Wikipedia. JBI International, formerly known as the Jewish Braille Institute, is an international nonprofit organization created to assist visually impaired and reading disabled people around the world by providing access to publications in Braille, large print, and audiobooks. Publications are made available in English, Hebrew, Hungarian, Russian, Polish, Romanian, Spanish, and Yiddish. The organization maintains a circulating library of books particularly related to Judaism and Jewish culture. The next section describes the history JBI International was founded as the Jewish Braille Institute of America on April 22, 1931, in the Manhattan borough of New York City. It was founded by Leopold Dubov with the assistance of Rabbi Michael Aronson. JBI, the Jewish Braille Institute, was funded in large part by the National Federation of Temple Sisterhoods, to whom Aronson appealed on Dubov's behalf for assistance. In spite of its location-specific name, its foundational purposes included compiling a census of blind Jews throughout the world and publishing a free international Braille magazine of Jewish culture. It also intended to adapt the Moon-type writing system into Yiddish and Hebrew, and to devise an international Hebrew Braille code. Other focuses included the religious instruction of blind Jewish children and the development of a Braille library for blind Jewish people of all ages. By 1932, the JBI had begun publication of its monthly The Jewish Braille Review, and it opened its library. The National Federation, now known as the Women of Reform Judaism, continued to support the JBI, not only financially, but through service, developing an international network of members to assist in translating for and disseminating books to its target audience. The next section is called the International Hebrew Braille Code. One of the primary challenges faced by the JBI was the lack of a uniform Hebrew Braille. JBI assembled an international panel to address the problem, and the first iteration of the International Hebrew Braille Code was produced in 1936, undergoing further refinements until its completion in 1944. One of the early masters of the new alphabet, Mrs. Harry Cole of Cleveland, Ohio, was called upon by JBI to undertake the first translation of the Hebrew Bible into Braille. She worked on the task of translating single-handedly for 5 years, although proofreaders scrutinized her work, before she completed the first Braille edition of the Hebrew Bible. In 1950, JBI International published the first Braille Torah. In 1955, JBI began a drive to help blind Jewish children achieve maturity in the Jewish faith through direct intervention or correspondence courses. In 1956, the Canadian Jewish Review opined that the Institute has become the source of Jewish culture and learning for the blind. They also noted that the International Hebrew Braille Code it had created had been used to, quote, to supersede and replace several regional Hebrew Braille alphabets that had long been considered inadequate. The final paragraph of the article from Wikipedia talks about relocation of the JBI. As the institution grew, it relocated several times. In 1953, it moved to 101 West 55th Street in Manhattan. In 1959, it relocated its headquarters to East 48th Street of New York City. Helen Keller, then in her late 70s, sent a message to its dedication ceremony indicating that, this is a quote from her, "With pride, I still read the Jewish Braille Review, which the Institute publishes for the blind, and I bless the spirit of sympathy and brotherhood in which it serves both Jews and Christians in many lands." That's a quote from Helen Keller back in the 1950s. By 1961, it housed its library there, 10,000 books in Braille, as well as an extensive collection of audiobooks. In 1968, it moved again to 110 East 30th Street in Manhattan, where it has remained. In 1972, when its library consisted of over 20,000 volumes, the new headquarters made press by developing a touch-and-smell fragrance garden on its grounds for the benefit of the blind. At that time, the JBI facilities also included a sound studio wherein it could produce its audiobooks. The Institute was renamed in 2001, and it's now called JBI International. It used to be called the Jewish Braille Institute. Okay, we have a couple of articles now to end the program, or to finish out the program, about glaucoma from the GLEAMS Glaucoma Research Foundation newsletter. The first one is one I mentioned in a previous program and didn't have time to get to you. MIGS, M-I-G-S. This is called The New Age of Glaucoma Surgery. It's written by Devinder Grover, who's a doctor. I'll tell you about him at the end. He's from Dallas, Texas. The article starts by saying, over the past 5 to 10 years, there has been a revolution in glaucoma surgery, specifically micro-invasive glaucoma surgery, commonly called MIGS, micro-invasive glaucoma surgery. A glaucoma is a disease where the optic nerve gets damaged, and the main risk factor is elevated eye pressure. This is also called intraocular pressure, or the IOP. The only treatment for glaucoma is to lower the IOP. The doctor author says, I often think of the inside of the eye, I like this analogy, like a drain and a faucet. And using this analogy, high IOP is related to an imbalance between the amount of fluid made inside the eye and the amount of fluid the eye can drain out. This fluid is called aqueous, and when we consider various treatment options to lower the IOP, we can either decrease the amount of aqueous the eye makes or increase the drainage of the aqueous from inside the eye. This goal can be accomplished with medications, laser, or surgery. The traditional glaucoma surgeries, which are called trabeculectomy and inserting glaucoma drainage devices, these are the traditional surgeries, while very effective, are associated with risks such as double vision, devastating eye infections, exposure of a drainage implant, swelling of the cornea, and excessively low IOP. Although these risks are relatively infrequent, they make most surgeons delay glaucoma surgery until all less invasive treatment options are maximized, such as medications and laser treatment. And also, they wait until the patient has definitive glaucoma worsening. Fortunately, the MIGS revolution, that's micro-invasive glaucoma surgery, the MIGS revolution has allowed us to change our approach to surgical glaucoma for many patients. The main theme and priority of MIGS is patient safety. While no surgery is without risk, MIGS provides improved safety while usually providing mild to moderate IOP lowering. MIGS can be thought of in a few broad categories, either of the category of enhancing the fluid outflow using the eye's inherent drainage system. These surgical procedures would be called GATT, G-A-T-T, which is the gonioscopy-assisted transluminal trabeculotomy. It can also be done by the K-hook dual-blade goniotomy, or the trabectomy, or the eye stent. This all enhances the fluid outflow. There's another category would be called shunting the fluid to the outside of the eye. This is done with XEN gel stent. And then we also have decreasing production of the fluid within the eye. This is done by ECP, which stands for endoscopic cyclophotocoagulation, which is an alternative laser procedure. This is decreasing the fluid within the eye. So these are three types of surgery: enhancing the fluid outflow with a drainage system, shunting the fluid, or decreasing the production of the fluid. Sometimes the MIGS procedures are FDA approved to be performed only in conjunction with cataract surgery. This would be the eye stent process, whereas other MIGS procedures are approved to be performed independent of cataract surgery. And this would be the GATT, the goniotomy, the trabectomy, the XN gel stent, and the ECP, which is the endoscopic cyclophotocoagulation. While MIGS procedures will not replace or eliminate traditional glaucoma surgery, they have greatly decreased the number of patients who require these more invasive surgeries to control their IOP. Moreover, MIGS procedures have allowed us to have lower threshold for surgical intervention with the goal of providing better IOP control while decreasing a patient's glaucoma medication burden. There are, without question, concerns about the MIGS procedures. The first concern pertains to efficacy. While some types of MIGS provide a very modest IOP lowering, other MIGS procedures have demonstrated sustained and significant IOP lowering. Typically, MIGS procedures that are more effective at lowering the IOP are also associated with slightly longer time to visual recovery. The second concern pertains to the cost and insurance coverage of these newer devices. The third concern is that some risks may not be fully understood until we have more data and longer follow-up on these procedures. The goal of the new age of glaucoma surgery is to improve safety while tailoring the surgery to the individual patient's disease stage and lifestyle. As a community, eye doctors need to continue to innovate and study outcomes for these procedures so we can maximize the efficacy and safety of glaucoma surgeries. Only time, experience, and careful studies will tell us which of these procedures will work best with which types of glaucoma patients. And once again, this was an article by Dr. David Devinder Grover, is an attending surgeon and clinician at the Glaucoma Associates of Texas, located in Dallas. Now, along with this article comes another article which explains the new priorities for glaucoma research. And I'll run down the list very quickly. Some new priorities: neuroprotection, the ability to keep the retinal ganglion cells alive. There's another one called neuroenhancement. It's the idea that we could give these cells a little booster shot and take sick cells that aren't functioning for a patient's vision and make them more functional again. Another priority for glaucoma research might be the retinal ganglion cell replacement, RGC. This involves using cellular sources, such as the Müller glia, retinal pigment epithelial cells, or the induced pluripotent stem cells, and then dividing strategies to promote efficient reprogramming of those cells. Another new priority would be the optic nerve regeneration, and this would be stimulating the axons to grow across an optic nerve injury site. And then there's one called, this is another new priority, vision restoration. It involves returning vision that already has been lost due to glaucoma. And this relies on the brain's plasticity, which is the ability to reorganize and return to certain functions. So these are some new approaches to treating, managing, and even curing glaucoma. Well, to end this program today, I have a quote for you to think about. This comes from Mahatma Gandhi. Happiness is when what you think, what you say, and what you do are all in harmony. Thank you for listening, and I hope you have a great week. You've been listening to Enabled, a production of WXXI Reach Out Radio in Rochester, New York. Our technical director is Maureen Rich, and I'm Nancy Zimmer. I hope you'll join me again next week for more updates and information and encouraging stories. If you'd like to hear this program again, you can listen to it at our website, wxxi.org.